Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch from the City of Champions. We talk every week about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today in the program, we'll go from CrossFit, yoga, and climbing with Brian House. He's from the newest gym in Park City. It's called Alpenfit.
Good morning, Lynn. And look at that snow just starting to come over the ridge.
Oh, yeah.
And congratulations to Ted Ligety and the Super G. That's all over the
news. Giant slalom.
Oh, sorry, giant slalom.
I know.
It's all over the news.
It was great. It was worth waking up in the middle of the night to watch.
And you saw the whole thing live.
I did.
Nice.
It was great.
So then we'll follow up that talk with wine. It's Master Sommelier Marnie Old with the best wine book ever. Really. Wine, a tasting course. Every class in a glass. This is the book you have to take on a weekend away with friends when you want to do a lot of studying and take a lot of classes in those glasses.
And finally, a conversation with Yale Law professors Amy Chua and Jed Rosenfeld. It's on their new book that's getting a lot of buzz, criticism, controversy, and especially a lot of ahas. It's called The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America.
This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino. I'm excited to announce a new Intermountain InstaCare right here in Park City. We provide access to urgent care without having to leave the area. Instead of waiting in line, call us at 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds and Rideboard and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, we hear that mixing it up with fitness not only keeps it fun and exciting, but it's also good for the body. Cross-training, avoiding overuse by doing multiple types of strength training and a big variety that achieves the goal of overall fitness. Throw in a little meditative practice and some adrenaline along with it, and you found yourself at Alpenfit in Park City. The new gym opened just 5 weeks ago. It's next to Rite Aid in the old Blockbuster building. And joining us now to talk about Alpenfit is its owner, Brian House. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we stopped by this morning and we checked it out. And it looks like a lot of fun. The biggest thing, or the thing that I noticed upon walking in, you said that a lot of people say it is, it's huge. I never knew that Blockbuster was so huge.
Yeah, I get that a lot. A lot of people are surprised. And when we were under construction, I told people we were building a gym with a climbing wall in the old Blockbuster. They would look at me like I was nuts. But I think it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And want to mention first that, you know, how do you mix yoga in with CrossFit that's very noisy, but you have a yoga studio in the back of the building. So talk about that first.
Yeah, that's correct. And part of it's scheduling. We try to avoid having those classes ongoing at the same time. Occasionally we do, but yeah, like you said, it's a separate room and we put some sound insulation in that wall. We had to totally rebuild the walls in the back of the space. So it works out pretty well, actually.
And the gym, Brian, is a bouldering gym, right? I mean, it's not a vertical climbing gym. I mean, when I say the gym, the climbing gym is not one of those vertical, and maybe that's where people were thinking, how can you do that in the old Blockbuster space? But it's a bouldering gym, so you only need to be how high off the ground?
Yeah, that's correct. Our walls are about 15 to 16 feet off the ground. And I think, you know, a lot of people that aren't familiar with bouldering are kind of confused when they see the building and see that we advertise that we have climbing. But once they get in there, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, so they're not going vertical, but you can cover a lot of ground horizontal. I mean, isn't that what bouldering in part is about? You kind of go up and move over and do those traverses, and you've got overhangs and all sorts of things there. Is there a way to link both sides of the walls? I didn't notice. Is there an arch that you can, if you're really good, get from one side
jump.
To the other?
No, it's kind of in two sections. We definitely looked at that, and I would love to have that. Maybe something we'll add on in the future. But for now, at least, along the long section of the wall, it's about 120 feet linearly that you can traverse. So it works pretty well for both traversing and going up and down.
So I don't know how a climbing gym works, but I would imagine that there are climbers that come in with lots of experience who try to make the most difficult route and make it along the whole linear footage of the gym. Is that how it works?
Yeah. You can go either way. You can either climb up and down or traverse horizontally. It kind of all depends. You know, if you want to work on your endurance and really focus on your technique, then traversing is a good way to go. If you just want to get stronger, then doing kind of shorter, what we call boulder problems, where you're just climbing up and down the wall, that's good for that too. And so we have routes that are taped to kind of help challenge yourself.
That's what all those colored tapes are on the holds, right? Aren't they indicating the level of difficulty and a route?
Yes, it's not just to confuse people.
Yeah, you walk in there and look at all those different
Hopefully
colors.
Hopefully you're not colorblind. So explain a little bit how this concept was born of mixing up so many different sports. And it kind of touches on a variety of groups, too, user groups, really. People who would be interested in CrossFit versus climbing versus yoga. And you're bringing it all together. So talk about the concept.
Right. So the original concept is to have a gym where people can train for outdoor sports. That's kind of our motto, is indoor training for outdoor life. Climbing gyms have been done before and have always been really successful. But we had this concept that, wouldn't be cool. It'd be cool if there was a place where not just climbers, but skiers and mountain bikers and, all kinds of cyclists and hikers could come and cross train to, train for their sports, get an overall better shape, avoid those overuse injuries, avoid those chronic injuries and symptoms by cross training, and, just have fun doing it and have a good community feel where they can, meet other people that are into the same kind of activities. And it would just be sort of not just a training, but a community center for outdoor activities.
And Brian, did this was the genesis of this combination something that came from your personal interests, or did you look at your spectrum, your universe of activities, and pick the three that you wanted to put together? How did that combination come about?
It was a little of both. Part of it's personal perspective, but part of it too is that, we want all of our different activities in the gym to share some common themes. Those themes are functional training, sort of cross training, good human movement. Like I said, to avoid injuries, climbing and CrossFit and yoga are big three right now. They're all kind of studies in human movement. Not only will you get stronger and fitter doing them, but you'll also develop good body mechanics and just become an overall better athlete who is going to be able to survive life better without, getting injured, and you'll have more fun doing things that you love.
Right. So we hear this term functional training a lot. How do you define it? I mean, I have my definition that I've made up in my head, but how do you define it?
In short, I would define it as just using movements for training, using movements that our bodies are built to do. Running, jumping, lifting, squatting, throwing, climbing. These are functional movements. These are what our bodies are built to do. We can do them safely. We can do them and they will make us stronger. They'll make us fitter. We'll get in better, aerobic shape, all those sorts of things. So these are functional fitness is not something that anyone has invented.
Right.
We're just doing things that our bodies do naturally and things that our bodies do well.
Okay.
And, thinking of that functional fitness aspect. I don't know if you guys have seen, I've noticed during the Olympics when I've been watching the Visa commercial with Billy DeMong, where he's got the weights on his shoulders and he's doing the squats and then leaping into the air. It's like squat leaps, or I don't even know what you would call that, but I was just like watching that going, that is so cool that he can do that. And no wonder, you know, I mean, think of how that applies to what he does. The jump, the takeoff on the jump. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's that power move. But just from our perspective, cross country skiing, wow, would that give you a little, you know, juice going up on any stride? I mean, that's where those guys get that power stride.
Yeah. So again, functional training right there. Billy DeMong, our Olympian. I like that. Visa's got it wired, don't they? So talk a little bit about, you know, there's this, you know, maybe growing concern about CrossFit and people getting injured. And I think a lot of it, from what I hear, has to do with the type of gym that is presenting CrossFit and also the type of training. So maybe you could help clarify some of those questions that people always have about CrossFit.
Sure. I'll kind of, I guess, have to answer that in two parts. First of all, in terms of the type of gym, CrossFit is kind of, it's kind of a general philosophy on training. It's not a very strict program. So gyms implement it in different ways. And CrossFit has been exploding in popularity. And so the gyms that offer CrossFit training have gone a couple of different directions. There are gyms that approach CrossFit as a competitive sport in its own right, the sport of fitness, as it brands itself. And so they essentially train their members to be CrossFitters.
Do the competitions and everything.
Compete. Exactly. So that's one way that it's gone. Another way is that, you know, to be frank, there are gyms out there that are kind of jumping on the bandwagon, just trying to capitalize on CrossFit's popularity. And there are gyms out there that are kind of what I call traditionalists that simply use CrossFit as a training tool to make better all around athletes, and that's kind of what we're going for.
Okay.
And how about the certification level and the competency of the trainers?
Right. That's a very valid
question. That's something that comes up.
Right. And you know, to be perfectly honest, it's not hard to get certified as a CrossFit instructor. But similarly, it's also not hard to get certified as a personal trainer or a group fitness instructor. You know, a lot of coaching disciplines in the fitness world, really, it's not a very rigorous requirement to get started. And so there's a lot of variation from trainer to trainer. And yeah, so that is a concern. And really, the only way I have to answer that is to say that, you know, different gyms, different coaches, some are good, some are bad. And so if someone's interested in getting started in CrossFit, I would just suggest that they, you know, go and visit a couple of gyms, see some classes in action, talk to the trainers, you know, sit through a class or two. And, you know, if you see a class where you have, you know, 20 members and one instructor and there's not a whole lot of oversight, then that's probably not somewhere you know, want to be. If you see, you know, a student that's struggling, you know, obviously not, you know, moving very well or not doing, you know, an exercise properly, and the trainer is there just kind of yelling at them to do it right, then that's probably not somewhere you want to be. And, you know, but if you watch, you know, good classes with, you know, experienced trainers, it's pretty obvious that they know what they're doing, and that's where you want to be.
And Brian, you're one of the instructors, one of the CrossFit instructors at AlpenFit. So talk a little bit about your athletic background and, you know, how it all ties in for you. Like, are you a climber? Are you a yogi? Do you do it all?
A little bit of everything. And I'm sure that skews my perspective towards, you know, fitness in general. I like to kind of do everything and not specialize too much in one thing. But yeah, my background is in outdoor sports, skiing, climbing, mountain biking. Actually used to work here at Park City Mountain Resort. I was a ski patroller here for 5 years. Did the wildland fire thing in the summers, so that was pretty you know, demanding job. And you know, until about 6 or 7 years ago, I hadn't stepped into a gym for years. you know, I skied and I climbed a mountain bike and that was great. And I thought I, you know, had it all figured out. And then one day my friend calls me up and says, hey, you should try this CrossFit thing. So I did, and it just killed me at first, but it kind of changed my whole perspective, and it made me realize that, yes, there is value to training for these sports that we enjoy, that when we have the mentality that we're just going to kind of go out and do them, we don't perform as well, we're more prone to injury, we start getting the overuse syndromes, and, you know, when I started training more in the gym and being a little bit smarter about how I approached it, I just found that it just made everything easier. My body felt better. And so that's kind of my perspective, and that's what I want to share with other people.
Yeah. You know, that gym training term for a lot of people, like myself, isn't one that's very appealing. You know, I'm like you just described, you hadn't been in a gym for years. I'm not a gym person, but I am finding that I am drawn to this CrossFit thing for probably similar reasons. I'm trying to figure it out. But, you know, going in there and thinking that I'm at a pretty high level of fitness for my age and knowing the things that I do and then getting absolutely crushed in the workouts that are so brief and so intense and just wondering how that can happen, but then realizing that it's a nice compliment and adds to my level of fitness is what I have found. And that's what you're describing as well. And I'm just wondering if you can, you know, expand on that a little bit for people who have this kind of aversion to the gym routine and the gym fitness, because it is a little bit different.
Right. And I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head of what we're trying to accomplish at AlpenFit and what sort of our challenge is. Obviously, there's a lot of gyms, fitness centers already in Park City. We're trying to draw, you know, the crowd just like you, people that have an aversion to the gym, that think it's, you know, just kind of a bunch of, you know, meatheads trying to, you know, look pretty basically. trying to show people how training can help them better perform at the things that they love to do. And, you know, it's an old cliche that I thought I was in shape until I tried CrossFit. You know, right. I hear that a lot, and it was the same experience with myself.
How do you get people through that initial hurdle? I mean, do they just have to step in there, or, you know, I mean, what draws people to the gym initially? I like the combination, because you can draw people who are looking to do yoga, climbing, or the gym experience with the CrossFit. So you draw from a much broader segment of the population, it seems to me, or you could, you know, you could theoretically appeal and get them through the door.
Yeah, and that's part of what we're going for, is that the climbing wall will bring a lot of people into the gym. And then our hopes is that they will see some of the other gym stuff going on and think, hey, maybe this is something that would have value for me. Maybe this is something that could help me.
And how about once you get them in the gym, how do you keep them? I mean, what sort of rate structure do you have and programs for comprehensive use of the gym, or is it all segmented by activity?
We have basically we do day passes and punch passes, and then we basically have two different membership options. They're essentially classes, no classes. So one option for people that mostly want to come in and climb and maybe just use some of the equipment on their own. And then we have our full membership, which is all classes included, CrossFit, yoga. And we'll be expanding our class schedule as we go, doing more sports-specific things, you know, like, say, for example, a ski conditioning class, things of that nature. And then as far as our structure goes, you know, since we are trying to appeal to the outdoor athletes in Park City, we don't do contracts or things like that. If someone wants to cancel their membership and take a few months off because the skiing's great, and then they want to come back in the spring, that's fine. We're not trying to penalize people for not being year-round gym rats.
That might actually incentivize people.
Yeah.
The non-penalizing might incentivize.
Right.
There you go. So one final question, Brian. First of all, you've got a great website, AlpenFit.com.
AlpenFitPC.com.
Okay. And then, So I love CrossFit. I'm a big believer in CrossFit. I've been involved in a research study, a pilot study. It's very small. It's just a control group of one. It's very anecdotal. But I'm here to tell you CrossFit helps you out there in the world in a big way. So because I haven't been doing it for the last almost year, and the overuse injuries and all that stuff are, it's testament enough to show me I want to do it. And I love yoga, and I've always liked the idea of learning how to climb. I've done it several times. Can I show up, and do you rent the shoes, or how do you do it?
Yes, we rent the shoes, and we now have we just started a beginner's night every other Tuesday. Basically, you can show up, you get half price on a day pass, and it comes with free instruction, just kind of basics you need to get started. And then kind of in the future, we'll be expanding our class schedule and offering more in terms of, learn to climb classes. But, that would be a great place to start now is our beginner's night. And that's on the website, what Tuesdays that's offered.
That. Okay.
I got to follow up on the nasty shoes. Do you have to wear those horrible, awful, tight-fitting, cramped little climbing shoes that big, fat feet like mine get stuffed into?
Yes.
I can't just show
simple.
Up and
no,
either
you,
bare
you don't
feet
have
or sneakers or something?
Well, we prefer not bare feet.
Yeah.
Sneakers work fine.
Okay.
You know, you'll definitely there is a slight bit of a masochism to climbing shoes.
God,
you learn to love the pain.
You just haven't found the right ones, Tim.
That's possible. It definitely helps to try on a few different pairs. And keep in mind they can be worn with socks or without. So you can always go up a size and wear them with socks, and you get kind of a middle ground between comfort and performance.
Yes, it's like the ski boot.
Oh, you
right?
called it comfort and performance. I'd like to call it comfort and torture.
Okay, you just go ahead, and we'll see how you perform with those climbing shoes that are three sizes too big. Very good. All right. Well, Brian House, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And again, it's alpenfitpc.com, and you can stop by anytime. It's in the old Blockbuster building right next to Rite Aid in Park City, and you're there from what are your hours?
Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 8:30 at night. Saturday, 8 to 6:30. Sorry, let me back up a sec. I said that wrong. Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 8:30. Saturday, 8 a.m. to 6:30. Sunday, 10 to 6:30.
Okay, lots of hours there. All right, Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back to make a very nice transition, I think, between yoga, climbing, and CrossFit right into wine. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, our next guest is a master sommelier. Her name is Marnie Old. She's a breath of fresh air in the wine world. She's known for her engaging and intuitive explanations of complex wine topics. And she believes that to understand wine, all you need to learn are a few powerful ideas, a handful of concepts that help explain wine's dramatic variations of style. And once you know why wine tastes the way they do and how to zero in on the styles that suit your taste, you'll feel more control when buying it. Her new book is called Simply Wine, A Tasting Course, Every Class in a Glass. And she's now joining us to talk about this new book and to talk about, well, a pretty fun subject. So good morning to you and welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good Good morning, Lynn. Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, first of all, Michael Mondavi of the famed Mondavi wine family, he kind of stole my words about your book. So I'll just go ahead and use his words, which are so great, really. He talks about how what you do in this book is to help people learn to trust their own palates. And I love how he says that, because that's exactly what you do, is you sort of break down the whole wine experience without dumbing it down, as he says, but you help people to find their own way with their own tastes.
Well, in the book, we talk about helping people to achieve their own vindependence and vinlightenment. That's really the purpose, is to let people take control of their wine experiences. People, especially in the U.S., because we have a culture here where wine wasn't on the table when most of us were growing up, we tend to have a little more insecurity when it comes to wine than with other beverages, other foodstuffs. And so what I see so often with the general public is people feeling like they need to learn the taste of the experts. They need to read the reviews and taste the right wines and learn to like them, even if they don't on first sip. Well, you know, that's a little silly. Wine is like anything else that's sensory driven. All of our arts, whether we talk about music or fashion or anything like that, it's okay to have personal tastes, and we've accepted that each individual will have a different preference based on their own personal feelings. In wine, somehow we discount that and make people feel like there's some kind of social yardstick value in what they choose to drink with dinner. It all seems a little artificial to me.
And Marnie, why is it that people find themselves afraid to trust their palate? I mean, that seems a little bit odd. Anytime somebody puts a glass of whatever's white or red in front of me, I don't have any trouble drinking it and thinking, oh, that tastes good or doesn't taste good.
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that wine is perceived as a symbol of success. It's also something that is associated with special occasions and with, you know, positive developments in people's lives. We have our first tastes of wine at people's weddings and graduations and these kinds of occasions. And when people taste wine, and maybe they're a beer drinker, maybe they're a cocktail drinker, they're coming at it from something else, the reality is that wine is a little different than most other alcoholic drinks. Most other alcoholic drinks are designed to give you their full flavor impact on first sip, and it's really easy to judge them on first taste. With wine, sometimes we want wines that give us an amazing first impression because we're going to drink them by themselves, but sometimes we want wine to be a food partner, and this complicates matters with wine tremendously, because wine, when it's designed to be more like a sauce on the side for food, that means that on first sip, sometimes it tastes a little more thin, sometimes it tastes a little more sour, a little less sweet than we might like. But all it means is to be put next to the right kind of food with the right components, with salt, with fat, and all of those glorious things that the chefs use in the kitchen, and suddenly the wine tastes magical. It's unfortunate, but we have an amazing beverage that's designed to be one of the best foils for food out there. But the fact that it does that so well can sometimes interfere with its first impression. And that creates this sort of acquired taste factor that really throws a monkey wrench into just judging things on first sip.
Marnie, Europeans are kind of ahead of the U.S. in this respect, aren't they? They've been pairing wines with food for many, many generations. And here in the U.S., we're just sort of, I mean, there is a fear factor. There is this sense that wine is different than other beverages and there's something to fear. Or am I mistaken about that?
No, I don't think you're mistaken at all. What's interesting, though, is that Americans tend to assume that Europeans know so much about wine. On one level, they're right, in the sense that there are some basic wine concepts that come more naturally to Europeans who are exposed to wine at younger ages and who are surrounded by it a little bit more in their culture. And those basics are things like the effect of climate, of sunshine and warmth on wine style. It makes total sense to a European that wines from warmer climates further south will be more intense, will be more intensely flavored, will be deeper colored, will be higher in alcohol, and thus will feel heavier in texture, and are often less tart, less acidic. those kinds of things go along with sunshine, ripening the grapes further in the vineyard, things that are just natural in the environment. Whereas when you buy wines from northern regions, they're more likely to be white, they're more likely to be tart, they're more likely to be light in texture, lower in alcohol. And so those kinds of big picture generalizations come much more naturally to people who are exposed to wine in a different way in those cultures. However, what's interesting is if you talk to people who come from Italy or people who come from France or people who come from Spain, they often feel insecure about wine knowledge as well, in that they know the wines of their local area quite well, like the back of their hand, to the point where, you know, my brother-in-law sells his barrels to this winery, and so that's the only brand I ever drink. However, they often have very little experience or understanding of the wines of the rest of the world. And I like to encourage Americans, especially those who, like me, don't live in one of the major wine regions. You know, I'm based in Philadelphia, not in Napa Valley. But we actually have an advantage in these regions because we get to evaluate the entire world's offerings at arm's length. We can choose the one that makes the most sense for this time of day, for this time of year, for the type of occasion that we're serving tonight, without having those kinds of biases built in that it has to come from somebody my brother knows.
Right.
And what ends up happening is that we have a great opportunity to evaluate the entire spectrum. It's like we get to taste the whole rainbow here.
Yeah, it's funny, Marnie. That reminds me of, I think I was in Tuscany tasting wine somewhere, and I tried to bring in, you know, a tie-in from California, and the person sitting next to me said, "Oh yeah, but these are real wines, not like California. Those aren't real wines."
Oh,
so
yeah.
So again, it's mm-hmm. that cultural, how it's tied into the culture there, and it can be very provincial and regional, like you say.
And to be honest, if you grew up in Tuscany and were suddenly given a glass of California wine, it is so different. It is so much higher in alcohol and, frankly, higher in sugar that it can be shocking to the palate if you're used to drinking something drier and lighter. And the reverse is also true. If you bring a Brunello to a tasting of California Merlots or Cabernets and put it into the mixed blind, it can taste sour and woody and funky and strange, even though it's a brilliant wine. We just have very different contexts, and sometimes things can get lost in translation.
Right. Now, Marnie, I wanted to ask you about some previous things that you've written and how they may compare to this book, book, Wine, A Tasting Course, a very simple title, but that kind of gives you a glimpse into the book itself, which you make everything so simple, and it's brilliantly done with all its graphics and boxes. And what did you put into this book that you hadn't put into your previous books?
Well, this is my fourth book, and my first book was very fun. It was a comparative book, sort of tongue-in-cheek, called He Said Beer, She Said Wine. I think you can imagine which side I was on that to be.
Yeah.
And then the second two were, again, very much oriented to a novice wine audience, people who wished they understood more about wine. One was called Wine Secrets, and then the second was a digital-only book for iPads and iPhones called Wine Simplified. And both of those are very good books. I'm very proud of them. I'm happy that I put them out. But I have to tell you, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and every time I see a new book the first time, it's really often the case that I feel a little disappointed. Something about it doesn't quite match the vision you had going into the project. And this is the first book. Wine, A Tasting Course is the first one that I was thrilled with the first time I had it in my hands. I have been working for 10 years to find a publisher willing to help me bring these visualizations to life. And DK specializes in illustrated books, full color on every page. They teamed me with a brilliant graphic designer in London. And between the two of us, I sent him my hacked-together graphics that I used for my PowerPoints in my wine classes, and he put out this incredibly beautifully designed book. It just crystallizes everything I was trying to communicate in images in such an easily digestible way. I've had nothing but positive response to it so far.
Marnie, what occurs to me is that you go out and purchase this book, and as you say, it's a course in wine tasting. So now you're in wine school, and you say that people who buy the book get a guide and a course on how to explore wines at home and on their own. And I'm thinking that the tuition begins when you buy the book, because now you're going to be out buying your course material and tasting as you go along with the book. And that could get very expensive, as tuition does these days.
Well, you know, yes and no. Many wine courses are designed for you to sit down and taste, you know, 6, 8, 10 wines at a time. There's usually 4 to 8 sessions in a class. That does add up, there's no question. But with this book, first off, you're starting off with a beautiful hardcover. And let's just picture for a second that you have a couple. You have a husband and wife. This is a perfect gift in the sense that it is something that allows that couple to have maybe 6 months worth of exploring and tasting wines, something that they can learn together where one of them doesn't already have more expertise. You know, it's always nice to come in on an even footing in something like that with couples. And what this book does is it does very small, focused tasting. So the number of bottles that you would actually need to buy and taste side by side to complete every tasting that's included in this book is far smaller than you would encounter in a standard wine course. It's designed to taste 2 or 3 wines side by side rather than the usual 6 or 8. It's designed to be able to execute with 2 people together at home or even in a restaurant in some cases. And by far the best way to use those tastings is actually to invite a few more people to the party. As you know, when you're tasting wine, there's 25 ounces in every bottle. To do most of these tastings, you probably only need 3 ounces per person. That means you could have 4 or 6 or 8 friends, only have to open one of these bottles, and everybody gets to share the lesson.
You don't know our friends, Marnie.
Well, I like to think of it as sort of like Sesame Street for adults with alcohol. You know, you could turn this into, you know, not the book club getting together once a month. You could do this as the wine club where you get together and do these tastings.
Yeah, as I was going through it and flipping through the pages and just the layout, Marnie, I wasn't even picturing 2 of us sitting down for this wine class together in this book. I'm picturing, you know, weekend away, you've got a bunch of friends, girls, guys, whatever it is, and you're sitting down and you're making this kind of the centerpiece of a really fun afternoon or evening. It's such a great book in the layout. Maybe you should just you take us briefly through the layout of it.
Sure. Well, it's very different from most wine books, and you notice that right when you open it up because of the illustrations. There are very few photographs in the book. They're only really used to set the tone at the opening of chapters. It's infographics, charts, diagrams, cutaway illustrations, and so on. And that makes it so much easier for me to help the reader focus on the exact concept that's being discussed at that time. It's also designed in many ways for the ADD. It's almost more like a magazine layout in that each individual page has nuggets of information, but there are no long blocks of text. It is each individual spread, each 2-page group is kind of unique. You could open the book, read that spread, and close it and go away with something you needed, some piece of useful information. But what's interesting and what beyond the visual sets this apart from other wine books is that most wine books focus on the information that is on wine labels, which is grapes and regions. And so they tend to give you a little bit of an intro and then jump right into Chardonnay versus Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Sauvignon versus Pinot Noir, Bordeaux versus Burgundy, Italy versus California. And unfortunately, until you have a few basic wine concepts, until you understand how the wine world works, the real difference between white and red wine, for example, or how grapes change in flavor as they ripen in the vineyard and how that gets reflected in the flavor once the wine is made and it's in your glass. Until you have those framing ideas, the details about grapes and regions, it's like memorizing multiplication tables without understanding the concept of this times that. Right? You need the idea. You need to understand the why for that other stuff to make sense. So what I do in the book is I put practical skills first. First, we talk about tasting. We introduce the language that we can use to communicate about wine. We talk about shopping, both in retail and in restaurant environments, about storing wine and serving it at home. Really, where the rubber meets the road, we try and address those questions for our readers first. Then the whole middle of the book introduces what I think of as those key concepts. They're really, you know, insider tricks of the trade, things that those of us in the wine business already know but are rarely explained to wine drinkers, concepts that help us understand and guess before we pull a cork what kind of end of the flavor spectrum a wine might fall at just based on things like its alcohol content or how many years it's been since the grapes were harvested. And then finally, at the very end, we come to that detail I was talking about before. There are sections at the end that give you great insight into the major grapes of the wine world, the major wine-producing regions of the wine world, but that's almost like an appendix. It's like the reference section at the back. The most important distinctive content in this book is in sections 1 and 2, the practical skills and the key concepts.
Marnie, as I said earlier, I'll drink anything that somebody puts in front of me, so I haven't been particularly interested in educating myself with regard to wine because, you know, I like it, and I know that. But I will say that this book really intrigues me and looks like something that, you know, someone like me would be very interested in.
Well, thank you. I take that as a great compliment because there are tons of wine books out there for people who already know something about wine. There are very few, though, that feel comfortable for people who are at your stage who I think of you as the wine curious, you know,
right.
Not the wine geek, not the wine snob, but the wine curious, the people who wish they knew just enough to feel a little more confident shopping for wine. If that's you, this book's for you.
That's right. And Marnie, before we let you go, I have a question, sort of a burning question. I've always wondered why this happens. So I'm kind of, I may be one step above Tim, I'll say, in my knowledge of wine and my curiosity, but I'm working on him here. But basically what I do when I go into the wine store is I look at the Wine Spectator rating and I compare it to price and I go for a varietal that I'm interested in. But what happens to me is I'll find a bottle that I love. And I mean, this is the best bottle I've ever tried, and I'll buy a case of it. What is it that happens? Is it my palate, or is it something that happens with the variety between bottles? But it always seems to sort of end up that I don't love the bottle. What's happening
it's
there?
You. Usually, it's not the wine. It's almost always you. It is true that there is something called bottle variation, that within a case of wine, if you open them all up on the same day and tasted them side by side, if the wine is sealed with cork as opposed to a screw cap, you'll find tiny little variations from one bottle to the next. And the older the wine is, the more those variations get amplified. But I don't think that's what you're talking about. I think what you're actually discussing is something that has more to do with food context. Mm. And we have a whole chapter in this book that talks about how to really understand food chemistry. There's a little demonstration that I encourage people to go through in one of those tastings in the parent chapter where you take two wines side by side and you taste them each by themselves first, then after a pinch of salt, and then again after a dab of honey. And it's absolutely dramatic, the change in our perception of a wine that we thought we loved. We can make it taste like toothpaste and orange juice bad. And sometimes a wine that we didn't love on first sip tastes fabulous after we put it through this kind of hoop. Now, our senses, we like to think that we're objective. We like to think that every time we taste wine, the experience is going to be the same, like snapping a photograph. But it's not. Our senses interpret the world differently all the time. Like, if you think about it, when you're in a conversation like we are now with only us talking, the sound of our voices carries very far, so we don't have to raise our voices. But if we were having the same interview in a crowded restaurant, we would have to be talking quite a bit louder to hear each other. Our senses adjust to the context, to the noise in the room. This happens with your sense of smell. This happens with your sense of taste. It happens with your sense of texture. All of the things that we appreciate in wine are fluid and react to what's happening around us. When we eat rich foods high in butter and olive oil, our wine seems lighter. When we taste sweet foods high in sugar, our wine tastes drier. When we taste foods high in salt, our wines taste less acidic, and so on. And so often those shifts that you're talking about are context-based. And, you know, there's a saying that they have in France when they train sommeliers over there. There's a little rule of thumb. It's sort of like white with fish, red with meat, but for wine salespeople. And they say in France, buy on an apple, sell on cheese. And what they mean by that is if you want to expose the flaws in a wine to see, you know, really its skeleton exposed and evaluate its structural integrity and you know, kick the tires on the wine, so to speak, you know, make sure it's in good shape, taste it with something that's sweet and tart, because that just shows you the wine, dry wines anyway, in the most negative light possible, so you see the flaws. But if you're selling, sell on cheese. Well, what does that mean? Put a wine with things that are rich in salt and fat if you want to disguise flaws, if you want wines to be shown in their best possible light. There's a reason, folks, that we do wine and cheese parties, but we don't do wine and cookie parties, and we don't do wine and sushi parties. It's cheese has salt and fat, the two things that are universally flattering to wine.
That was a very comprehensive answer to my question. I love that. I can't wait to test it out. So our guest is Marnie Old. She's the author of Wine, a Tasting Course, Every Class in a Glass. And Marnie, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on a wonderful book, and one I am going to take along with my weekend away next week with a couple friends.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Tim. It's really been a pleasure to join you today.
You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from deposit accounts to business lending. We have one branch in Park City and two branches in Heber and Midway, Heber Valley Bank. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
Hi, I'm Seth Adams from River Horse on Main, a proud sponsor of A Splendid Table on KPCW. Winter is upon us, and River Horse's dining experience includes views overlooking historic Main Street. We are open nightly at 5 p.m., 435-649-3536, or riverhorseparkcity.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney, who is giddy about the snow dumping outside.
I went from happy as the first little burst of snow came over the ridge to sad while we were talking to Brian from Alpenfit because it stopped and looked like it was even clearing up. And now I can report with a smile on my face that it's dumping.
It is dumping in Old Town, and I don't know how widespread it is. Looks like the weatherman showing that it's maybe not so widespread. So enjoy it now, because in 2 hours from now, it could be sunny.
That's right.
Who
not
knows?
Not much behind the front, but let's enjoy the front while it lays down some snow.
So, Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, they are co-authors of the book. They are spouses, and they are both law professors at Yale. They say, well, among other groups, Mormons have recently risen to astonishing business success. Cubans in Miami climb from poverty to prosperity in a generation. Nigerians earn doctorates at stunningly high rates. Indian and Chinese Americans have much higher incomes than other Americans. Jews may have the highest of all. They say certain groups do much better in America than others, as measured by income, occupational status, test scores, and so on. But it's difficult to talk about, in large part because the topic feels racially charged. The irony that Rosenfeld and Chua suggest is that the facts actually debunk racial stereotypes. They're joining us to talk about their new book and its controversy, criticism, and aha moments. Amy Chua and Jed Rosenfeld, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's just begin here. The thing I enjoyed most about researching your book is all the controversy and really criticism that it's drawn. And I feel it's because people are missing the point. I feel like we're engaged in so much rhetoric about race, and they're afraid of what you're saying about race. So straighten that out for us.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you for that. So we are talking about three qualities that anyone of any race, any background can have that we say propel some individuals and some groups to success. And those three qualities, say, a sense of exceptionality, mixed in with, secondly, a dash of insecurity to kind of make you feel like you need to prove yourself, and third, impulse control. And the controversy seems to be people who haven't read the book say, you're saying that some groups are better than others, and it's exactly the opposite. We're saying, look, these qualities anybody could have, and some of America's most successful groups are African-American and Hispanic-American, so it has nothing to do with race. The groups also that are successful change over time, so Chinese-Americans are successful for two generations, and then after that, they go back, they're no better academically than the rest of the population, so it's nothing intrinsic. It's something in the families. It's something often in that first generation, a way that they're instilling drive and grit and a work ethic in their families. And can we not look at that, unpack it, and try to all learn from it?
If you're just joining us, our guests are Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. They're co-authors of the book Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America.
Amy and Jed, you both talk about one of the elements of the triple package being self-esteem and insecurity, and you kind of link insecurity with self-esteem and talking in at length about kind of America's situation where we're building up everyone's self-esteem, and maybe that's counterproductive. But I read something this morning that I thought was really interesting, and there's a study that apparently has just come out that said that people with low self-esteem, their brains shrink 20% over a 15-year period during this study. And I think this is one of the misconceptions. Could you clarify kind of security and self-esteem?
Sure. Well, I'd have to see that study because I'll just tell you on the face of it, I don't believe that. It's very interesting. So American educators and to some extent families have been for a while now kind of really taken up with the self-esteem movement, the idea that if you just make people feel good about themselves, they'll feel happy and they'll do better. Well, there have been tons of research studies into this, and the data just disprove that. So quite the contrary, if you give kids self-esteem boosting messages, but you don't connect that with earned self-esteem, you disconnect it from achievement, you just tell them they're great no matter what they do, it makes them perform less well, and it makes them less happy. There's more psychological problems growing up, makes them kind of fragile and anxious in a way, it turns out. So I would really have to look at that study. What we're saying is we've got to move away from that. This dash of insecurity that Amy's talking about, we did not expect to find this, but in all of the groups that are doing a little bit better right now, you find them communicating to themselves and their kids this anti-self-esteem message, kind of like, hey, you've got to go out and earn it before you feel good about yourself.
And there's another one of the American themes that you touched on, which is the concept of immediate gratification. And, you know, again, I think there's some there might be an opportunity to clarify, because we hear, well, not only we hear, but currently we hear sort of this theme that links back to traditional philosophies and religions about being present. And you talk about, you know, there's this thin line between being present and immediate gratification, which again can be counterproductive.
Oh, you've got that exactly right too. We found that we all want to live in the moment, but when that turns into immediate gratification and just doing whatever you feel like, you know, and who cares about the consequences? Who cares about the future? That is a recipe for not doing well psychologically, economically, and all the studies show that.
It's interesting. We talk about fulfillment too, you know, because there's this idea of immediate gratification. You just take whatever you want and just eat it right then. But, you know, if you think about all the values that most of us care about, family is generally not about immediate gratification. It's a commitment. You know, it's a commitment to your spouse. It's a commitment to your children. So, you know, that's I think there's a deeper sense of living in the moment that's like, you know, really living a fulfilling, you know, experiencing things that value to you, not just like, you know, consuming everything immediately and forgetting about it.
But people are really measuring this now. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners know about the marshmallow test. They put kids, 3-, 4-, 5-year-old kids, at a table. They gave them a marshmallow, and they said, look, you can eat that marshmallow right now if you want, but if you wait 15 minutes, you can have 2 marshmallows. Well, most of the kids ate the marshmallow, but about a third of them waited the whole 15 minutes. When they tracked those kids 20 years later, and they did so almost by mistake, but when they tracked them, it turned out the kids who had waited were outperforming the others just crazily, disproportionately, educationally, in terms of their jobs, making more money, stronger families, staying out of jail, less substance abuse, on every measure. And this finding has been replicated all over the world. So if you can strengthen that ability in kids, that direction toward the future, it turns out that's one of the most important things these groups and these cultures are doing.
Impulse control. That's wonderful. Now, finally, and we have just a half a minute left, you're not identifying a metric of success so much as you are a metric for what creates drive. That's the final point I wanted you to clarify quickly.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because this, it's really, I think we're all interested. How do we motivate and inspire our children to reach their goals, whatever their goals may be? Their goals may not be financial success. It may be public service. It may be art. It may be something different. But our book is about how do you generate that kind of hunger and drive. And in addition to that, the ability then to realize that drive. And, you know, can we learn something from the groups that at this moment seem to be doing disproportionately well?
Amy and Jed, next time we want you to spend an hour with us, okay?
We love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that was Amy Chua and Jed Rosenfeld. That is a great book. I like the message in there. I think it's very interesting. I also find it curious how much controversy and criticism it's drawn as well. But I think if people get past the race thing, which was really used for anecdotal reasons, right. I think, in the book.
I agree.
Very good. Let's thank our underwriters.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Park City Clinic, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and San Francisco Design.
Also thank our guest today, Brian House of Alpen Fit Park City, and Marnie Old, Master Sommelier with Wine, a tasting course, every class in a glass. And of course, Amy Chua and Jed Rosenfeld. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Want to remind you, you can always access archive shows at kpcw.org under shows, programs is the tab, and The Mountain Life. Also tune in tomorrow to Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. We'll be talking about privacy in the age of big data.